For as long as I can remember, I've found myself searching. Searching for meaning, for understanding, and trying to find the true essence of who I am. To make sense of all of the knowledge that's out there, and how I could use that to be the best version of myself. Physically, emotionally, spiritually, and professionally. Through my own experiences and conversations with inspiring people sharing their authentic stories, I've realized that the answers to some of life's most challenging problems often lie in very simple messages. So join me on a journey of discovery where I speak to real people with real stories sharing real insights. I'm Sanjeev, and you're listening to my podcast series, Just Another Lens. Welcome to this episode of Just Another Lens. On this episode, we're going to delve deep into the concept of resilience. Is resilience something that we're born with? Do you ever know when you're resilient enough? Or is it a process, an ongoing process where you expect the unexpected? I remember when I was a child learning about the way the world works. And I remember one particular thing that resonates. There was this story about the journey of a caterpillar to a butterfly. And as the children observed this, there was a period where they had to be really patient, a tough time. When it was encased in a shell, the cocoon. And it's so tempting as an observer, as a bystander, to have pity, to try and break open that shell to help this butterfly release. But what we've learned is that unless it goes through those difficult times to break through, it won't survive in the real world. And so it is with us in life, that, you know, we're all dealt a certain deck of cards, but it's how we play those cards that's important. Having to overcome challenges just makes us stronger, or can make us stronger. We can either choose to fail or crumble in those moments, or realize this is just part of our journey of fulfilling our full potential. And today on our show, we have an inspiring gentleman, Stephen Adjaye, somebody I've known for a few years, somebody who's overcome no end of trauma and pain to achieve his success. He's an international best-selling author, a mentor, and an entrepreneur. Stephen, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Just Another Lens.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I've been following you for quite some time now and reading your posts. I think your message, your authenticity resonates with so many people than you probably realize, so many more people. So I was chuffed to bits when you first agreed to join me on this podcast journey of mine. I think it was probably, 2 years ago when I first reached out? I remember trying to coordinate a call with you. And I was in Mumbai. And where were you at the time?
I was in Plymouth.
It was in Plymouth. So it was like crazy evening time in Mumbai. And I remember this call where we got to know each other. And in that call, I knew that I just had to have you on this podcast. There was so much that we shared, but I thought this is just so wonderful that you were able to put it in words. So thank you so much for that. So for those of you, the listeners out there who don't know you, Stephen, do you want to just introduce yourself? Tell us who Stephen is.
Yeah, but thank you, Sanjeev. Obviously, the same goes to you. I've been following you even before you started following me, following in secrets. And that call was transformational for me as well, because how you appeared when I spoke to you was like you were really, really authentic. You were vulnerable. And for the first time talking to someone like that, there was an instant connection. I'm really, really privileged that I'm here. So I'm Stephen Adjaye, and I'm a Ghanaian-British entrepreneur, pharmacist by training, but author by passion, author and writer by passion. I'm also a poet, and I also do healthcare investments.
Amazing. I mean, I don't know if we're going to be able to touch on all of those things today. But you come from very humble beginnings. And one of the things I've learned along my journey is that when I was young, I looked for inspiration where it was obvious. You know, the headlines, the news, the books, the famous people. I'd look at people's trappings and I'm thinking, well, how do you get there? And in my journey, initially I remember my parents telling me, work hard, stay out of trouble. You've got to get these grades to get this degree to be able to be successful. And you know, I just didn't fit. But what I've realized is that it doesn't have to be that way, that there are surrounding us in this real world. There are people like you who come from an equally challenging background, who have somehow navigated their way to success. And in your way, multiple successes. So I like to start from the beginning. Yeah. Through this podcast series, I think I'm going to do this with everybody. What deck of cards were dealt with at the beginning? For some people, that's it. They think, okay, it's either great or it's not. But I don't think it's as simple as that. I believe it's how you play those deck of cards. So tell us about your early life, your early childhood, Stephen.
I think for me, it was quite different because the struggles found me later. My first 10 years were amazing. I have an amazing dad. Amazing mom. I was born in London. My dad decided to move back to Ghana in West Africa when I was 5 years old. Had a lovely childhood. Nothing really to write home about. Went to a good school. Finished, went to university, qualified to be a pharmacist, then came here.
So let me take you back. Let's slow down. Let's break that down.
Yeah.
Okay. So you said your first 10 years were fantastic. Yeah. So who was in your world? Who were the important people and places in your world at that time?
Definitely my dad. My dad has been a massive inspiration, still is, still alive. He was just such a humble man. He was the center of the community. He was a chief in his village and very highly educated. He's a lawyer. And I just find him amazing. I still do. My mom was a little bit more, a little bit more strict on the strict side. My dad was just an inspiration. He just loved to inspire people. And I think a lot of what I have now is from him, if I'm honest. I also had a few uncles and aunties that were inspirational as well. So I'm lucky that even when I went off track in my later years, my dad was always a North Star, what we call what good looks like. So even though when I, in the bad years, I always had a point of reference that if I could just do this way, that's what my dad did. And if I could follow the same path, I'll be fine. So for me, that's the main thing I'll say.
So your dad's always been your anchor, your North Star. Yes. Your North Star. You mentioned, you know, your mother's role in all of this. And I know you're right about her too. So at the time, I'm not talking about in the rearview mirror, I'm talking about at the time, what did that feel like? What were the practical ways that your mother influenced your life?
I credit my book to my mother, actually, because she came from a very humble background. She never really had a good education. But she forced me to read. She literally forced me to read. So she was a fishmonger. So during the day, she'll go to sell her fish and then she'll buy a book and bring it to me. And she made me read it. I didn't like reading at the time. And she was very strict, you know, like talking African strict or like Indian strict.
Okay, Indian strict. I know what that's like.
Yeah, you know what it's like. Yeah, I mean, slightly off the cuff with human rights, but you know what I mean? But this she was a strong woman. She still is a strong woman. But I credit the book to her because she's the one that instilled in me the discipline to read and to write. So in that case, so my mother was a strict one with a loud voice. And my dad was the quiet one with inspiration. So I think of the two, I had a good balance.
A good balance. But, you know, it's a reality of life that when we're going through the growth, there are those who give us the guardrails, and especially when we're young, probably don't appreciate the value of those. Yeah. So yeah, I can relate to that. I mean, in my household, believe it or not, you said you're brought up in Ghana. My mother, my grandfather were in Kenya.
Yeah.
And I was born in Kenya, but I came to the UK as a little puppy.
Yeah.
So I, unfortunately, my memories of Kenya and that lovely lifestyle were all on home movies. But in terms of the home environment, I kind of relate to the two dynamic.
Yeah.
I mean, my father was the strict one.
Oh, okay.
So strict one meaning, you know, he lost his father when he was 12 years old. Mm. And he took charge of responsibility for looking after the family. So I guess that conditioned him about how to fight and get ahead in life.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it's all about hard work, all about being disciplined.
Yeah.
But there was so much good in that, you know.
Yeah.
Worry about what you can do, not about anybody else.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, around me, perhaps my cousins were getting away with more than I would. But my father always said to me, listen, I look after you. My responsibility is you and your brother. So it came from a place of love, which I'm sure you kind of relate to. That's why I dedicated the book to your mum. And my mother was the inspiration in a different way. So that personality, my mother, in those times in East Africa, from an Indian family, a Gujarati Hindu Indian family, my grandfather was so forward thinking. Actually, think about it, probably my grandfather was inspiration. But my mother followed that through family values. He had all of his daughters educated and out there working and, you know, being part of society. She was a touch typist who could type 60, 70 words per minute. And I was going,
wow,
how does that even work?
Wow, in those days.
So, that discipline at home, absolutely. So you said for you, your first 10 years were great.
Yeah.
So then tell me about the next stage of your life. So after that, what happened?
So I went to, I think the first 10 years were great. And then I went to a school called Achimota, which is one of Ghana's best schools. And I'm quite a gentle person by nature, quite empathetic, quite soft heart.
You're a gentle giant, if I might say.
Yeah. So that's when the bullying hit me. So from 11 to 15 years old, I got terribly bullied. I mean, in the 80s, it wasn't so so regulated as it was now. So
at that age, you were here or in?
I was in Ghana. So,
and you were getting bullied at school?
Yeah, I got bullied at school because obviously they saw me as the British kid, you know, who was born in London. So in Ghana, there was that kind of thing that look at him, he's the British kid, you know. So I couldn't really speak the language properly. So I got bullied really badly. So my first 3 or 4 years were horrendous.
And what form did that bullying take?
All sorts. I mean, and the bullying was heavy. It was like beating and stuff that I can't even mention because it was quite horrendous. But as I got older, when I got 15, 16 years old, and obviously I became a senior then, so things got easier. But I think it left scars. I'm thinking about it now, which I've never said before, but I think it left some scars, which precipitated the stuff that I went into in the book when I got a bit older.
Yeah.
But I think those times were not very good times.
So you said they left scars, Stephen. I know we've got a lot to talk about today. But if you were talking to your younger self going through that period, because there's a lot of people listening who'll be listening to this podcast who are being bullied. And that might not just be at school. That might be bullied in their social lives at work. What advice would you give them?
It's a tough one. I think for me, and I was thinking about this today, actually, when I was on my way here, which would be in my next newsletter. It's the core values, isn't it? You need to know who you are deep. I know if you're young, it's not just not that easy because you're young. But I think I was helped because my dad instilled into me all the time that you are someone that's important. He knew right from the start that there was something different about me somehow. So that was there. That was always down there somewhere. So even when the bullying was there, somewhere in, my dad used to remind me all the time that there's something about you that's different. You know, you are made to be different. So even in those days, looking like I did now, I call it as like a diamond in the rough. So even though there's so much stuff around it, around the diamond, there's so much cobwebs, so to speak, deep down I knew there was something there, you know, which I couldn't quite. And that something has been with me throughout my life, even when I became a pharmacist. There was always, I knew something, there was something more. It was only in 2020, during the pandemic, that I finally found out. Well, I went to business school in Warwick, which you know that. So that was the beginning of finding out who I really was. But it was actually through a series of events, which were also bad events, that I finally began to realize that actually this is what I should be doing.
So that's going back to eventually. So you again refer back to your father as your North Star, I think, from what I'm hearing, that he believed in you.
Mm.
And so finding somebody who believes in you.
Mm.
In all the years I've been coaching and mentoring, there's gems that I pick up.
Yeah.
You know what? You know, sometimes I've had conversations with people, and over a period of time, the light bulbs go on.
Yeah.
The path isn't always smooth, and I kind of sit there and analyze, well, what was going on there?
Mm.
And I realized that all of us, me included, absolutely. Like I put myself, absolutely, I need this. Need people around us who believe in us.
Oh, yeah.
We don't always have to get it right. You know, the discipline of our cultural background, need to get it right, need to pass, need to get these grades. But somebody who looks at you as with compassion, certainly as your father did.
Mm.
But for those who don't have that figure in the family, I mean, for me, it's sharing that find those people. You know, if you don't have those people in your circle, then change your circle. Yeah. It's okay. You know, if you find that you're surrounded by people who are toxic, who undermine you, then you have to be vulnerable and brave to realize that there's no value in this. And then looking to move into different circles, find different people to help support you, I think is important, Stephen.
100%.
So, finding somebody who believes in you. I think lesson number one,
yeah,
through whatever challenges you're getting, looking for people or persons or help that can support you, believe in you and tell you it's okay.
Yeah, so my mom, like I said before, my dad and my mom, there was no electricity in those days. Ghana was going through a really hard time. There was a military takeover, so that there was a curfew and there was no electricity. So my mom used to cook, as they do every day. She did all the cooking, morning to evening. I don't know how she did it. And all I had to do was when she lighted the charcoal, and you had to fan it because you can't cook when the fire is burning. It needs to be on hot coals. So I had to do that, fan it all the time until the embers became red. And she had a place where my mom was very organized. So after you fan it and the embers come, you need to put the fan at a particular place.
Got it.
Okay. If you don't do that, the next time she comes to cook, she can't find the fan and she gets upset. In those days, I was very disorganized. I think it was the creative part of me. You know, you're very disorganized. So I never put the fan back, ever. And I used to just go off into the sunshine, play football. When it's time for tea, she can't find the fan. She called me, Stephen, where is this fan gone? You've lost it again. She got upset. So I had to go around looking for the fan and finding it. It took me ages. And that delayed the tea, which didn't make her very happy. So I used that again in my book, about finding your fan. So I use the fan as the fan is something that you find the coal pot with, which lights the fire so you can cook.
Yeah.
In this case, you want people that will light your fire. People that will light your fire so you can cook, you know. So a lot of people, like you just said, a lot of people have people that believe in them. But you also have a part. You have to nurture those people. You have to find who they are and nurture them. I have three or four people in my life who I nurture because those are the guys who are always cheering me on. In the dark days, in the bad days, in the good days, I can count on my friend Brian to cheer me on. I can count on my friend Kate to cheer me on. So those people are people that I really, really treasure. And they're people that I find, and they're always my fans, and I always have to find them.
That is a beautiful message. That is a beautiful message. From my sort of spiritual teachings, there's a message that, again, from my early childhood programming, keep the company of two wise people and five good friends. That's a universal truth, that in the toughest of times, nowhere to go. Yeah. And they don't just suddenly appear. You have to find them, like you said. Yeah. And I love the way you explain that in the context of your home environment. Yeah. Well, mom says, here, you need to fan this fire. Otherwise, dinner's not happening. And when you finish that, make sure you know where you put it. We've all been there, right? But that's a beautiful way of remembering that those people, those places of inspiration, you need to find them and nurture them. That's a beautiful message, Stephen. So moving on from your childhood, your sort of siblings, what's your family?
So I've got, I had a sister, which is another story I'll talk to you about, who died suddenly. But I also have a brother who is also in England. He's in Basingstoke. And he's the head of Illumio. Illumio is like a software company. They do cybersecurity. And he's the head of that with the whole of Africa and Asia. So he's doing quite well. Yeah, he's quite well. So 10 years younger than me. And he had the same inspiration for my dad as well. My mom was a bit gentler with him, I must say, because I think she learned her lessons.
She learned her lessons. Yeah, there's a lot of elder siblings saying, got it easier. Younger ones have got it easier.
I think I was the experiment and he was the finished product. So, yeah, but he's also doing brilliant, extremely proud of him. He's one of my fans. And anytime I have a problem or every time I feel down, if I go to Michael, I know he's going to cheer me up and put me back in where I'm supposed to be. So, yeah.
Apologies if this is a bit too sensitive, but
go for it.
You mentioned you lost your sister. Yeah. You know, I can't imagine losing one of my, I mean, I've got a brother. I've lost both my parents in the last couple of years. And, you know, we all handle trauma differently. And I don't even think it's just handling trauma differently. The way I responded, you know, if I go back to my early situation, early 2020, COVID, you will have seen me for the first time probably put up social media posts, bury it all out there, vulnerable. But I found myself, despite all of that planning and insight about this pandemic's coming, because I had my brother Shashi in Australia, who I dearly love, who I speak to almost every day, telling me a couple of months in advance, Sanjeev, this is coming, so you need to prepare for lockdown. And my practical brain, you know, all the years of experience, and I got out all the resources. I went shopping to the DIY store, bought heaters, bought lights, all of that stuff. And I remember my family saying, what are you doing? I said, listen, watch the news. You know, I've been talking to my brother Shashi. And they went, but aren't you overreacting? I went, what's the worst that's going to happen? The worst that's going to happen is I've got a bunch of supplies I'm not using. But at least we're prepared if it comes to it. And we know what happened. Yeah. But despite all of that preparedness, I found that of all of the people I knew, the fire started in my house. You know, in mid-March 2020, I started getting the symptoms of COVID. My wife did, and I saw it fan out to my two kids and my parents. That led to both my father and I getting in hospital in ICU when nobody knew what this alien thing was. And when I lost him, I was determined to keep fighting. Although I loved him dearly and he'd lived with me all that time, I was at peace in that, you know, we'd done everything we could. And we weren't alone in this journey. It was the whole of humanity. We just one of the ones chosen for this part. So I came out really positive, determined to try and share whatever I could each day. And that's part of what Sanjeev Speaks is about. I think that's where he was born. But just be honest, vulnerable, authentic. And if something out there can help somebody in some small way, then it has been worth it. That day has been worth it. But then when I lost my mother, suddenly after our call, December 2020, we had our call and she was with me in India. And 3 days afterwards, when we came home, out of the blue, lights out.
Yeah, that was shocking. I remember that.
But that hit me in a totally different way. So I'm coming back to you here. You mentioned briefly you lost your sister. How was that for you in the, at the moment in the time?
It was terrible because I was in bed in here in Plymouth and my sister was in Ghana. So my mom rang me at 4 a.m. in the morning. I didn't pick it. I thought, oh, I'll speak to her later. I was too sleepy. And my wife had had a terrible night. She couldn't sleep. So I said, I'll speak to her later. So I didn't pick the call. I said, I'll ring you. So my brother rang me 2 hours later. I said, your sister's dead. And the guilt that I felt, because when my mom was ringing me, my sister was really, really poorly. So the first thing was the guilt that I felt after that. The second thing that happened as well is I'd gone bankrupt from the business. I was completely broke. And I didn't even have money to take the bus. And it's probably like same in India. Funerals are an expensive thing, you know, in Ghana. So when we had to go down to bury her, I had no money. Zilch, absolutely no money. So we had to do a lot of overtime at work. We had to cobble some few things here and there to just afford the flight to get to Ghana. When we got to Ghana, she wasn't buried yet. She just obviously died and they put her in the mortuary. And in Ghana, what happens is you pay for people. It's probably the same in India. You pay for people to come and embalm her and do all that stuff. They put her in turn up in time. She had to leave the mortuary. She was just lying there, had to go and carry her. I mean, she was dead. I mean, I had to carry her one of the mortuary guy stuff and put her in the coffin. And that has stayed with me since. Because looking at her, it's dead. And I had to just carry her myself. And so even then, literally, she got embalmed and she looked lovely. Obviously, as far as people are dead could. That has stayed with me ever since. The father had to carry my dead sister.
So, you know, Stephen.
Yeah, that was not a good experience.
Yeah, that's really a deep insight into that moment. Again, there's a reason I think it's worth exploring and sharing what I did.
Yeah.
Because dealing with trauma, and you've faced so much trauma, for me it's like eventually you have to face it.
Yeah.
Eventually you have to look at it and get past it. So in terms of growing out of it, getting past that, can you remember what you were telling yourself and how you came out of that?
Yeah, so she had learning challenges as well. So when that happened, the first 3 or 4 days was terrible, probably because of the guilt that I felt when I didn't pick the call. But then I told myself, there's nothing I could have done about it, even if I had picked a call, because I was 6,000 miles away. And she led a good life. She was the most loving person they could ever meet. She loved everyone. And even though she had serious mental health challenges, everyone loved her. She embraced everyone. So for me, the memory, I choose to dwell on that memory, the fact that she was a loving person and all that she did. So I tried to talk to myself too, and gradually it has got better. It's just talking to myself and saying, look, she lived a lovely life. People loved her. Yes, it's painful that she's gone. It was painful that I had to carry her into the coffin myself, looking at her dead body. But it's all been worth it because out of that is where the book came. There were 3 things that happened to me that made me write the book, and she was one of them. So if she hadn't died, probably this book wouldn't be. I wouldn't be here with you today.
Stephen, again, you know, you're sharing some insight. You don't even realize how useful and powerful that is. But there's ultimately a choice in any moment. Yeah. None of us can guarantee the future. I mean, there's a lot of talk about mindfulness. And again, I'm thinking, well, What is that about?
Yeah.
Ultimately, it's about letting go of the past, learning from it, taking whatever you can in a positive way. And it's hard, especially when it's a loss. You said you went bankrupt. Oh. This happened, this traumatic situation. But ultimately, the way out of it is the way out of it. Oh. And I found myself in a similar journey, still on, where I'm coaching myself, mentoring myself, telling myself exactly what I'll be telling other people, which is, okay, there's no guarantees in life. You've got to look for the positive memories. And in the case of your business, what can you learn? You know, from the bankruptcy that you faced. I know, maybe we'll move on to that now.
Yeah.
But from every moment, whether it's a high moment or a low moment, there's something to learn.
Yeah.
And a reality that life will throw us a curveball when we least expect it. That doesn't mean we go around being fearful of it. It's just we become more resilient.
Yeah.
So thank you for sharing that. I know that there'll be many people who are suffering in a similar way, but hopefully they have hope that you can get through it. And it doesn't have to be overnight, and there's no quick fix. It's a process. And having those good people around you, those fans, is going to help you in that. And I know you reached out to me, Stephen, by the way.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah, just I could tell that something was wrong. Because I always used to read your posts all the time, and suddenly went silent. And I thought, what's happening? So I was brave enough to do that.
No, and you were compassionate, kind enough, and intuitive enough to do that. In that traumatic situation, people respond in different ways. And I was very clear for me that when I was going out, as I said to you, after COVID, the purpose of being on social media, the purpose of messaging is for something to be useful to others.
Yeah.
And I remember putting the post up after my father passed away about, excuse me, what I'd learned from COVID, because I was in an ICU unit.
Yeah.
And I kind of went, this is what's happened. Some of you know about it. I appreciate the messages, but this is the message and learning I want you to understand. And I remember getting all of these sympathetic messages, really sorry for your loss, really sorry for your loss. And I went, pointed back to, really appreciate it, but this is what I'm doing it for.
Yeah.
And so when I lost my mom, it was like a vacuum.
Yeah.
And it's about getting through the short periods, getting through the initial phase. Then taking not even a day, taking a period of a day as it came. But for me, putting stuff out on social media where I thought, well, what do I put out that's of value with it for others? And I was determined to try and get through this because I knew I would. I knew that. That's the clarity I had.
Yeah.
When it felt right, then I'd be able to share that journey with how I got through it. So to me, it's a constructive process. Yeah. So yeah, I can relate to you, and I don't think I've heard you say this anywhere else, so thanks for sharing it.
No worries. It's fine.
Let's move over to the business world now.
Okay.
Because we shared a lot of common experience in that world. Yeah. So you're going to tell us about this journey that eventually led to bankruptcy. But tell the listeners about that journey. Where did it start and what happened?
Yeah, so like I said, there was always something in me that I knew how to do more. So far, to leave Ghana and come and qualify as a farm assistant and go and live in a city where it was 99% whites alone itself was an achievement. But there was something more. I always felt so. The first 2-3 years of being a farm assistant was brilliant. Loved it. Earning good money. Got myself a nice house in the countryside. Well, not in the countryside, in the city, by the countryside. But there was this staring. And I told my wife, I had to do something more. She said, you're crazy. You know, you have 2 lovely kids. I'm a beautiful woman. I've got a good job. What is more? What more is, but there was that staring. So that's why I decided to go to Warwick. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I just knew that I had to follow this thing that was in me. So I went to Warwick. Absolutely loved it. Did my projects on African healthcare.
So for those who don't know Warwick Business School, one of the top business schools in the world.
Yes.
So you went to Warwick Business School.
Warwick Business School, yeah.
Yeah.
So got my MBA and came out. I was all guns blazing. I'm going to do this. So with a friend of mine, Abhinav, who we're still friends with now, he's still my partner now after 15 years. We started a company called Blue Cloud. So the idea was, when we qualified, when I qualified, Africa was booming then. But it was booming in oil and gas and energy. That was where. So I thought, right, I'm the man. I'm going to transform healthcare in Africa. So started Blue Cloud Health, got a few projects going in Africa. We did some work in Kenya, obviously where you're from.
Yeah.
Did some work in Botswana, in Ghana, in Nigeria. We had a plan. We mapped up about 5 or 6 countries which were safe.
So what did Blue Cloud do again?
Yeah. So what we did is we took companies that had promise, coached them and mentored them.
So fledgling companies.
Fledgling companies. And get to a point where they could get investments. Okay. And then I tapped into my investment contacts here in the UK, in the Middle East. Abhinav was strong in the Middle East. And then got investments for them so they could scale.
Yeah.
That was the original plan. We did some of that in Ghana and in Botswana and, like I said, in Kenya. But we got a bit cocky, to be honest. And a deal came up in Angola, which by then was really booming as well. The oil was booming and they had very bad healthcare systems. So we had this deal, a $60 million deal to build.
$16 million.
Build a massive healthcare structure in Luanda. So we started it, flew to Luanda twice, met the Secretary of Minister of Health, had a wonderful deal, signed it all. I thought, this is it. I've made it. I was waiting for the Range Rover.
You got to the top of the mountain. Yes, I've got it.
This is what life was about. It's just easy. People are talking about, you know, I heard people's stories. What are they talking about? You know, suffering and pain. They didn't get it right. They didn't have a good business plan. You know, I've gone to the best school in the world, one of the best schools in the world. This is it. We made it. And then we got duped massively.
We got duped
in the deal. So we lost everything. I lost everything.
Okay. Is there anything you can share about how you got duped? You don't have to.
I don't know. I will. So we at the time we were it's a three-way deal. So it was me, the guys in Angola, and the guys who were actually investing the money. And obviously, because being a healthcare guy and being African, I was like that. We were like the people that could do the glue.
You were the middle people to bring it together.
But what happened was, we didn't know this, but they had gone behind our backs to do the deal without us.
You got bypassed.
Yeah. So we invested a lot of money in offices in Dubai. We had an office in Accra. We had an office in Johannesburg. We had an office in London. So we invested a lot of money because we wanted to expand the business. And that's one of the lessons. You don't go too quick, too fast. You know, went too fast, too quick. So when the deal fell through, we lost a lot of money. A lot.
How did you realize? Because it sounds like you were having these three-way conversations.
Yeah.
Not known to you, they were having conversations behind the scenes.
Yeah.
You were investing, if I heard this
right,
in offices in Dubai and elsewhere. Yeah. Saying, yeah, we're here, we're sorted.
Yeah.
So let's get the infrastructure in place. Yeah. And that was your money.
Yeah.
So was there a specific moment you realized it just went
bang? Things went silent. And apart from that as well, we did some work as well in Francophone Africa. So Francophone Africa is countries like Niger, Senegal, which were colonized by France.
Okay.
And they also didn't have very good healthcare facilities. Everything came from France. So we started a Blue Cloud Medicines, where we had a Blue Cloud range of medicines, which you always have to register.
Mm-hmm.
So we got duped on both sides. We got duped by our African partners, Francophone Africa, which we lost hundreds of thousands of pounds. And suddenly things went silent in Angola. So we just went silent. We sent emails, we called, no response. And then things went dead. And then later we found out that it happened and we had no idea. So yeah, that was a bad time. Lost a lot of money, like I said, and then had to go bankrupt. We had nothing. And the process, I developed epilepsy, which meant
you developed epilepsy. I hadn't realized you developed
I
thought you always had it.
No, I had it. I developed it then. Wow. 2012 to 2013. So I developed epilepsy really, really badly. I think it's more the stress.
Do you think it's possibly due to the stress and the challenges of all of this trauma?
I think the gene was there because my sister had it as well, but I never really, really had any problems with epilepsy till then. But I think that triggered the gene. I don't know. But yeah, so that came in.
So you had it all happening, at the same time.
All happening. And then because of all that, I made some bad decisions when it came to because I felt so bad. I forgot my fans were always there for me. But, you know, when things get, when you get to that kind of dark circles, I just didn't connect with them anymore.
So let's just, if I just want to pause a second.
Please, yeah.
So there you are, driven to achieve more when you had a comfortable life. I think that resonates with people out there. Your wife, your partner saying, why do you need more? Everything's fine. But something inside you tells you this is where you want to go. You go and do an MBA, you get a business plan together and you set this business up and it's coming together, it's working. But you get to a stage, if I heard that right, that you shut off, you put the blinkers on. I can relate to that.
100%.
The further down the path of success you go, of I guess any environment maybe, but you start to become desensitized, I think, to the signals.
Yes.
And so you didn't pick up the signals of these people you're talking to, actually.
Yeah.
It didn't happen overnight. This is something that happened over a period of time, but you just didn't pick up the signals.
100%.
And then you faced catastrophe.
Yeah.
Having to face your wife.
Yep.
You had your fans, as you said, the people to support you around you. But what was going through your mind? What kinds of thoughts are going through your mind that you shut yourself off?
I think I couldn't believe it. And in those days, Sanjeev, you probably know this stuff about vulnerability and being open. It's only just come out in the 20s, I think, in the last 5-6 years. When we were in school, obviously this is not Warwick or anything like that, but you just read books about Steve Jobs, all the books that were around at that time, were Built to Last by Jim Collins and Steve Jobs and all these guys that you see, and they didn't tell you the bad part. All you knew was the good part.
Yeah.
So we were not prepared. When I left my MBA, finished my MBA, I was not prepared for that part that nobody talked about. Nobody talked about it then.
I don't think they still do. To be fair, in most academic places, and even on social media, they always talk about the success. And the success in hindsight.
Yeah.
But like you said, you don't hear about the failures. No. So... You're sharing. About.
Yeah. So I wasn't trained for that. I had nobody in my life that I knew had gone through that. So I was completely unprepared for it. So when that happened to me, the epilepsy, the bankruptcy, obviously my sister dying, all that stuff happened to me. I just went into a bad place. And then I found pornography. And that became something I used to do quite regularly. And it's like an addiction. You start off looking at little things, and then by the time you realize you're really deep into it. So those and that made me a worse person. Luckily, I was a pharmacist then; I could go to work, but I was a shadow. I was not there, really there.
So you mentioned you turned to pornography again. Very brave of you, I would say, to even share that. But people turn to addiction, and you said something else, which I think is really telling. That you weren't proud of what you were doing.
No,
you
hated it.
You hated what you were turning to. Mm. And that could be anything that gives you stimulus, right? Mm. We're looking for that hedonic kick.
Yeah.
Something to give us some sort of lift, and people take to substance abuse or whatever else it is, or their behaviors. But it's a horrible place to be.
Horrible.
So then from that place, tell us about your journey out.
So it got to a point where I realized I could not continue living. I was living a lie. My wife didn't know. I had this aura around me as a person who was good, very respected. So I knew I was living a double life, and that used to eat at me a lot. Obviously, adding a bankruptcy to it, adding the epilepsy to it, my sister's death, it became like a curveball. So one day when it got really, really bad, and I was crying. I went online to find out what can I do about this. And I found this company called Covenant Eyes. And they gave you a list of stuff.
What was it called, sorry?
Covenant Eyes.
Covenant Eyes.
Covenant. That's like having a covenant.
Yeah.
Eyes. So what it does is it recommends some steps that you need to follow. So the first step you need to follow is I had to download their systems onto my phone. And then you have to find four accountable people. And my fans were there. So my brother and Brian, my friend, I wasn't brave enough to send it to Kate's, but Brian and two other people that I deeply respected. And what happens is anytime you try and look at something, you will send them an email. Now, my brother looked up to me. I was the elder brother. And the thought of him receiving an email that his big brother was looking at stuff that he shouldn't be looking at was enough of an incentive. And then also had people, like I said, accountability partners. I opened up to them, went through a lot of counseling, got a bankruptcy thing in place where I could obviously live relatively okay and pay off those debts. Got the epilepsy sorted. So I went to see a consultant. I still have it now. I actually had a fit not too long ago, two or three years ago. So it's still there. But they were able to put him on medication, which was able to control the fits. But I think what helped me most, I used to journal a lot. I did a lot of writing, and that comes down to my mother.
You journal a lot.
I journal a lot. I have tons and tons of journals.
And journaling, was it structured or how was that for you?
It was structured in a way where I had dates and stuff. But I also just used to write whatever came into my mind. I just used to write and write. And that was a therapy. So it wasn't afterwards, about a year or two after I'd come all through all this stuff. The company was, you know, dead. But as I was going through my journals, I realized that there was a pattern to the pain, which I never realized before. And that's when I came up with this flight response pain model, which I write about in the book.
Flight response pain.
Yeah. Which basically means that all pain that we face feels the same. So if you all feel the same, you all feel pain emotionally. But actually, there are four kinds of pain that everyone goes through. And if you don't react to that pain properly, you're never going to get better. So I realized from the journals that, and I used a calendar system to coordinate them. So the first one I called was red flag pain. Red flag pain. Red flag because when you're driving and you get to a red flag, you don't stop, you will crash your car. Okay. So red flag pain is the feeling of self-sabotage, which in my case was the pornography. It's the stuff that you do to yourself that makes you a worse person. And no matter what happens, the key is to stop doing it. You can go for counseling, but the aim is if you don't stop what you're doing, you will crash your car.
Okay.
And that was the red flag pain. The second pain that I realized from my journals is what I call an amber flag pain, which is the pain of waiting.
So let me just make sure I got the red flag right. Sorry, apologies.
Yeah, no, please.
So the red flag pain is recognizing the pain that is just making things worse.
Yes.
So recognizing it and any of the pain is part one of all of this. But recognizing what a red flag is this is you're just digging a bigger hole.
Yeah.
And then reaching out, being vulnerable, open, brave to go do what you've got to do to stop this.
Yes.
And then look for support, look for counseling, look for accountability.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Then we move on to
amber flag. Yeah. And adding to that, all the people that I did a lot of research into this pain, with all the people that have Elizabeth Holmes, Harvey Weinstein, Jeffrey Epstein, all these guys that crashed. And actually, if you look back into their lives, that red flag pain was there. Jeffrey Epstein, for instance, I wrote about him in the book. He went to a school called Dalton in 1976. And he started then looking at small little girls. If you don't deal with it, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and ultimately it will crush you. So that's what happens with red flag pain. That's why you need to stop it. And that was good, yeah. So the next one is amber flag pain. Amber flag pain is the pain of waiting, okay? I mean, you know this, Sanjeev, you're a very spiritual guy. Some things you have to wait for them. It doesn't matter how quickly you try to force it, it will never happen. I mean, you can never speed it up, you know? And sometimes what I did to try and speed things up actually made things worse.
So what you're describing there, if I understand it, Stephen, is the sort of pain that there is no quick fix.
Yes.
It's an acknowledgement, again, back to recognizing it, being able to stand back and say, okay, there's no quick fix. And allowing, you know, we all know time, there's this phrase, time heals.
Yeah.
However it might sound flippant to people, but there's a reality if you accept. Life flows. The seasons flow.
Yeah, you say that all the time. Yeah, you do.
Yeah, so it will change.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a matter of understanding that and giving it that time and giving yourself that time. So from that, those amber flags, was there anything specific that you could point to that people could do apart from being patient?
Yeah, so, and I read about that a lot. So that waiting time, coming an active waiting time or a passive waiting time, depending on how you say it. Businesses normally, before they're successful, take an average of 10 years. Normally, before you see real success, it normally takes 10 years. So there's a 10-year period of waiting. Obviously, you're doing activity and stuff around it, but actually, to actually see real success, it's probably about a decade. Some people are easier, are luckier, they get it earlier. Some people are not so lucky, they get it later.
I'm glad you use the term luck in there, because something you said earlier about when you were on your journey of business, people who are failing, what are you talking about? You haven't planned properly. And I still come across those people. And fair enough, everything they've done so far has been successful, but that doesn't guarantee success going forward.
No.
And I work with a lot of business leaders, whether it's corporates or entrepreneurs. And there's a reality of this, that most entrepreneurs, most startups fail within 3 years.
Right.
And then it's from 3 years onwards you start measuring, really.
Yeah.
And so your research tells you success, you really know it's success, whatever that's termed as in business, is around 10 years' time.
Yeah.
So tell me about the active passive then.
Yeah. So active tennis, you build yourself during those times you're waiting. Okay. So that means anything from having a coach, having mentors, reading books, going for courses, building your resilience. Because sometimes, and that happened to me, when you get successful too quickly, your foundations are not strong enough. You haven't built the foundation strong enough. So it overwhelms you, which happened to us. We were overwhelmed by the success. So people that are really successful over a long period of time have actually built a strong foundation. And that strong foundation comes during the amber flag period. Okay, I call it increasing your personal capacity. You all got a capacity of some point. And actually, I got this from watching on the news. So these people, refugees, they were displaced and they had to go for food. And the aid agency, an NGO, had to pour soup into their, so they go with a cup. And this guy came in, this guy went in there, he had a cup filled to the brim, he went off. Second person came, the cup was smaller. So he put soup into the cup, one ladle was full, had to go. Another person came in, he had holes at the bottom of his cup, he didn't realize. So the more they were putting in the thing, they didn't realize until, I suppose, I saw the soup, it was all dripping down, And that gave me the thought of personal capacity. The person who was able to build the capacity can take in more and more without drowning. The person who has holes in their capacity, red flag pain, for instance, you're not disciplined. You have all these things that are happening. The more you put, you might get a success, but it's going to drip out. So that amber flag pain is a good time for you to build your capacity. So when you get to that time when you are successful, you have the deep foundations, you have the preparation. So when it comes, you're doing well.
So it's a time where you fill the holes in your ship, your business, in yourself.
Yes.
You do that by education, by building a team of people around you.
Yep.
And people like the fans. Yep. People in that environment, we talked about coaching and mentoring. Yep. Yep. And as I said, I just naturally fell into that after my journey of a roller coaster in business where I faced people probably didn't have the same ethics and morals that I had. And I made some tough choices. But off the back of that journey, I realized that what I was missing in that period, we probably grew too quickly or got too emotionally into it too quickly. Yeah. And I didn't have that clarity of people around me to help put up the mirror and help me see.
Yeah.
Because as you did the MBA, right? I say it to whether I'm a corporate group or a business school, it's like, hey, you guys are the smartest people when you're looking at a case study outwards. We need people to help us look at the case study, reflect of us, yes. stand outside yeah. and go, hey, yeah. have a look at this. What do you think? Yeah. So that's amazing. So then what happens after the amber flag then?
So then you have two more flags. So the green flag, so the green flag paint. I call it amber because you have to wait, basically. Because when you're driving, you get to amber, you yeah. wait. You can't just... and then green flag is when you get to a green flag, you don't stop, you go. And I call green flag the pain of voices, okay? So people might tell you, Steve, what you're doing is never going to work. Or Sanjeev, this course, this stuff you're doing is never going to work. It's rubbish. You know, you're writing, you want to start writing a book. People come in and tell you, oh, there's so many books out there on entrepreneurship. How do you think you can make a difference? And people told me that when I started writing Peter Price. Really close friends came to me and said, I mean, Jim Collins, there's Jim Collins and James Clear and all these huge guys that have been, who do you think you are? You know, a black guy from humble beginnings in a little town in the Southwest who nobody even knows. People, when I say I live in Plymouth, people always say Portsmouth. You know, people there.
I said that, sorry. No. I did. But yes, Plymouth.
Yeah.
It's there.
Yeah, people don't know who you are. People don't know where you come from. So who do you think you are? Those are green flag pains. You know, you feel the pain that people are telling you, people that you love, who are close to you, are telling you these things. And because you respect them and you love them, you listen to them and you give up on your dream. You don't give up on your dream, you keep going. So even though people are saying things to you that are negative, people are saying things to you that are bad, you still keep going.
That's why I call it a green flag pain.
Yeah, go for it.
How do you know and how do you fuel that against the tide of people saying no? They love you, but they don't believe in you or they believe in this. How do you counter that, Stephen?
That's a good question. And I speak about it intensively, about the concept of validation. So the first thing, it starts from the guts, wasn't it? So you know inside that there's something there. But the gut is not enough. You know, you need to do outside validation. What is it that's working? So in my case, I knew Blue Cloud would work because Africa was ripe. Everybody was going into Africa. So I knew that the concept was good. I got it validated because I had a first class in my MBA with a project. So I knew that the project was good. You know, the business itself was good.
Yeah.
However, things happen in life, doesn't it? I mean, I talk about what you call the Rutherford principle, where I think 100 years ago, Rutherford was the first person to describe the atom and use a gold foil. So what did he had a gold foil. He shoots alpha particles. Some of the particles go straight. Some of them hit and they bounce. Some of them hit and they bounce back. Some of them go straight. You're lucky. Your business plan is good. You've started it. It's gone straight. Sometimes the alpha parts go. They hit the nucleus and they bounce. So sometimes you try something. Oh, like you. I mean, like you just said with you. You know, you try something. Actually, it didn't work. But let's go this way and that works. Sometimes you try something and it bounces back at you. So you have to either give up or try something completely different. But you never know till you try. You never know it till you try. So you can put some things in place to increase your chance of success, which I did. You know, if it wasn't for my red flag pain and the stuff I did, I probably would have succeeded. You know, so you put things in place, which may not guarantee, but it makes your odds of success better.
But what kinds of things, Stephen?
So for me, it was the markets. So I look at them in my case.
Okay, so validating what you're doing externally, independently, where, okay, but this stands regardless of what other people think. So
yes,
that's there.
Yes.
Putting those, doing the research.
Doing the work in
the background to reinforce that.
Yeah, reinforce that. And your own gut feeling. You know,
and your own gut.
Your own instinct tells you that this is something that you should be doing. You know, so if you don't, so those are things that are in place. So there are chances that what people are saying are correct. And you might just not make it. But the chances are that you might make it. You know, and if you listen to those voices and you stop, then you're never going to make it anyway.
That to me encapsulates so much of just living. There are no guarantees in life.
No.
You have to be in it to win it. And the ones who succeed, we hear these kinds of things. I see them on social media posts. But it's the truth that the ones who succeed are the ones who keep getting back up and keep going again, reinventing, rerouting.
Yeah.
Have that passion, have the reason why. Yeah. The number of times, even I look in the mirror, I go, why am I doing this? I'm doing this because I want to make a difference every single day and I want to spend the rest of my life doing that. to as many people as possible in every avenue that I can reach.
Yeah.
Because that, in the joy of others, for me, my guru, my mentor, Brahmo Swami Maharaj's message was, in the joy of others lies our own. In the progress of others rests our own. Yeah. And that's my reason why.
100%.
How that then comes out in practice doesn't matter. And it's not about numbers, it's about how it feels. It's about going, yeah, okay. But also learning from the signals, from the research, and pivoting or adjusting. But being true to yourself.
Yeah.
That takes me back to you and your authenticity, Stephen. So all of this, the one of the reasons I really wanted to speak to you and share a conversation with you is that you are you. There's no mask, there's no front, and that's powerful. That's where you learn. So red flag, amber flag, green flag, research.
Just one more.
One more.
So one more is what we call the white flag. And I got this from Kenya, actually, Sanjeev.
Okay.
So one day we went to this restaurant in Kenya, when I was in Kenya, in Nairobi. I love meat. I'm a vegetarian, so apologies.
It's all good.
Well, I do love meat. So there's this restaurant in Nairobi, which serves just meat. And I went with my friend Abhinav, and we went and sat there. And the rules are simple. You pay an upfront fee, I think it's 3,000 shillings, and they serve you meat. Okay? And they have meat on skewers. They don't tell what meat it is, it's just meat. Okay. Actually, from that day, my love for meat began to go down. Because I ate so much meat. So I'm actually going to follow your footsteps to become a vegetarian. But yeah, the more you eat, they'll keep bringing it to you. Everyone has a white flag on the side of the plate. So when you have enough, you actually put the white flag on your plate. And that means that I surrender. Can't take any more meat. And they'll see the white flag and they don't bother you anymore. Life is the same, okay? So some things that you have to surrender to, okay? For me, it was epilepsy. There's nothing I can do about it. I've been to some of the best consultants in the world. They've given me medication, but it still flares up, you know? It's a matter of using that white flag. For me, the epilepsy is a white flag. It's part of my nature. I may be lucky one day and they may come up with a wonderful invention that may cure it, but for now, it's not. It's after 15 years, I still have it. But it's using the white flag as a source of power. For me, I would pay the price when I had an epileptic fit. Okay, so one day I was upstairs hoovering and trying to be a good husband and a good man and just clean. And then I had this massive fit and I had this massive hoover in my hand and I crashed down the vacuum cleaner down the stairs and I went straight into a radiator. And if I show you my back, it's really massive scars all in my back. And I had all these journals that I've written and I thought to myself, I have to write a book, okay. But I never had the courage. But after I crashed into a radiator and there was blood everywhere, my kids were screaming, I just had an epiphany. I don't know what it is, epiphany, a dream, a vision, I don't know what you would call it, but I saw myself holding a book. And I thought, when I came out, dressed my wounds, I refused to go to the hospital, which I should have really, but I didn't. I got dressings, dressed all my wounds, and I sat down behind a chair, took a pen and paper, and but in 4 months' time, the book was done.
Wow. So from this
white flag,
literally crashing and covered in blood, you had this epiphany, this light bulb moment, and you saw yourself with a book, and 4 months later,
there we are.
Pay the price.
Yes.
Pay the price. That's amazing. And that cut through all of the green flags and everything. Yeah. Just clarity, focus, go. Yeah.
And that's for my white flag. That's my epilepsy, which I'd already surrendered to. When it came, when I first got diagnosed with it, I refused to surrender. I thought I'm going to be a big shot. I'm going to eat well. I'm going to sleep, do all the stuff that I had to do, but it's still coming back. I could have a good night's sleep. Wake up in the morning, go to the bathroom and still have a massive fit. I mean, my wife, I'm married to a wonderful woman and she come and pick me up from the bathroom naked. Sometimes I don't know where I am. That has been my life for the past. It's getting better now as the medication is getting better, but that's been my life. But it's out of that I felt ashamed to say before, because there's always a stigma with epilepsy, you know, and I had fits at work. I've had meetings where I've had fits and I'll be on the floor, you know, really embarrassing. It really demeans you as a person. You know, your mouth is foaming and it's just really, really demeaning. But it's out of that book came. And that's why I call it white flag pain. We all have it, Sanjay. Mine sounds a bit, but we all have it. You probably have yours where there's some stuff in your life where you've had to surrender to.
Absolutely. Whilst you're describing this, I'm trying to relate it to my everyday life.
Yeah.
And there's, as much as I look back and there's been doors I've pushed and pushed, and they just keep freaking bouncing back and hitting in the face. And kind of my way of relating to this is going, well, some things you just have to accept. We have a deck of cards.
Yeah.
And when you stop wasting time giving that energy, because it's there, it's your deck of cards. Yeah. It's what you do with those cards, how you play them.
100%.
Is where the power is. Yeah. And your moment of clarity. Epilepsy hasn't gone away, but it doesn't take your energy and your focus. And it's become one of your pillars of strength, because that's part of who you are. Yeah. That's a great insight into your journey.
Yeah.
Into this amazing way of looking at the world and business and your personal life. So that takes us to the four flags. So you're a poet. Musician?
Not yet. I have no skills when it comes to singing. For some reason, I can't play. I love music. So, I mean, Pay the Price is the first book with a Spotify playlist. Which
That's why I asked about the musician, yeah, because so you I have love a playlist.
Music. Yeah. I absolutely love it. A lot of my second book that I'm writing, I take a lot of inspiration from music, not just from the music itself, but from the lives of the musicians. You know, so my second book now is about permanence. And I use the example of Coldplay. You know, I've studied Coldplay very carefully. Why have they remained so successful after 25 years? And they're still making headlines. What made Elton John, after 25 years, so successful? And he's still successful, you know? And if you look at them, there's some characteristics that they have that makes them that way, you know? And for me, that was the thing about music. The fact that there are two strands of it, the music that they play themselves, the lyrics, which are really inspirational, and the music themselves, and the people as well, their stories. And for me, they combine to form a powerful thing, which is why for me, music is really part of my life. It's a shame that I wasn't given the gift to play it. My voice is absolutely atrocious. I can't sing. But I appreciate and love music and arts and poetry. So that's part of...
You're living every moment to the fullest.
Yes.
You're an observer of life. You have an acute ability to see patterns.
Yeah.
I mean... You, in passing, said, yeah, I did my MBA and I got a first class. That's no joke from one of the top business schools to get that, right? So, but it just tunes into what, you know, you have this ability. And the way now you're going into your second book, and I love reading the synopsis. I'm looking forward to the full book. But you're a brilliant storyteller.
Thank you.
Your own stories, but you observe the world and people around for those patterns. For what's working, why is it working here? And you put it together in some sort of model, which I love, because that's how people can take something practical away. And like I said, it's a joy to be around you.
Thank you.
Is there anything extra you wanted to share with us about permanence or anything else?
So, I mean, I love what you said about you getting up every day and trying to make a difference in people's lives. Again, talking about patterns, there's a concept of legacy, isn't it? Where we all want to leave a good legacy in people's lives. You want to do everything, and you do that brilliantly, Sanjay, for me. And I can't believe how many people you've touched, right from kids all the way to professors and CEOs. And that's what you epitome. That's what you do every day.
I try my best.
You do. Well, you're doing a brilliant job of it. And that's why I reached out to you in the first place. But I realized that everyone's legacy is not the same, you know. And I realized, again, talking about patterns, that there were actually four kinds of legacies, which I'll just share briefly, which for me have begun to inform the way I live my life every day. So there's the first legacy of a philanthropist, which is somebody who basically lives their lives to be kind and do good for other people. Then there's the legacy of the purist. So the purist is someone like Jeff Bezos, Steve Jobs, Twitter, what's his name again? Elon Musk. Yeah. Those guys' legacies are in their work. Okay. So when you think about Steve Jobs, you don't think about somebody who leaves money to the poor. That's not him. Yeah. His legacy is in his job. And then you have what you call the profligates, whose legacy is the legacy of red flag pain, which is Harvey Epstein. But the legacy that I'm trying to achieve is what you call the pathfinder. And the pathfinder is a person who leaves a legacy both in his work and his life.
Wow.
You know, so I think now, if something I wanted to say to all business people is, yes, Steve Jobs is great. Jeff Bezos is great. These guys have done good work, Elon Musk, but they are purists. When you think about Steve Jobs, or you think about his Apple, when you think about Jeff Bezos, or you think about his Amazon, you don't think of Jeff Bezos as somebody who goes around feeding the poor or helping the sick. Just that. So it's not enough to just be a philanthropist. That's good. It's not enough to just be a purist. That's also good. You definitely want to be a profligate. You don't want to live a bad legacy in your life. But the world we should all aspire to is what I call the pathfinder, which is a person who does good in the business and also does good outside the business in general. So after all that I've gone through, and all that I've said, and all that I've written, that is the life I want to live my life. I want to have a develop a great business and also be recognized as somebody who's also done great for the world. And that's what I'll say. That would be my closing thing, if this was a closing.
That's, I don't think I can top that one. I think that's incredibly powerful. It's the kind of thing the world needs. It needs leaders who are principled, ethical, yes, successful. Yes. Because a good friend of mine who's a CEO of a multi-billion dollar company said to me, we want to make a difference in the world, but unless we're making money, we can't make that difference.
Yes, that's true.
And then the pathfinder to me, with all of the stuff you're writing, is actually more than the business success and the personal life, the way you're living it. I think you're shining a light on the path for others to find their way.
Yes.
So thank you, Stephen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, it's been a pleasure. No, I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Yeah, me too. And I look forward to reading the book. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's really kind of you, Stephen. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so everybody, pay the price from Stephen Energy.
Cool.
Thank you so much. I'm privileged.
No, privilege is mine, my friend. Thank you very much.
So that was the amazing Stephen Ajay. What an inspiring man. Somebody who from his earliest childhood has faced challenges, both physically, mentally, emotionally. Yet he's not let that break him. You know, surrounding us in this world, people walk around with masks. But what I've learned is that everybody, and I mean everybody, faces challenges below the surface. But how we choose to manage those challenges, how we learn to overcome them, and learn from the message of inspiring people like Stephen is up to us. Do we fall and crumble? Or do we look for inspiration, look for opportunity, look for a way to reinvent ourselves? Remember, life is a series of moments, some highs and some lows. But how we choose to stitch them together is up to us. If you like something from this episode, if something resonates, please don't forget to comment below and subscribe and share. Looking forward to seeing you on the next episode of Just Another Lens.